Well, we know that everything that's being done, while sincerely meant, is not working. What really upsets me personally, however, is that the people who proclaim the need to make poverty history are doing so with such gusto and such confidence that they know how to abolish poverty in the world that they're actually consequently misleading people. People are therefore falling for the idea that having a few global rock concerts and persuading governments to delete the debts of a few countries is going to make a material difference. I regret to say that that's not the case. We need more fundamental thinking, and people like Bob Geldof and Bono, while they are sincere in wanting to help the poor of the third world, are actually by setting red herrings going, are actually misleading people by the million into thinking that we're on the road to solving poverty. We're not.
Well, how long has mankind been trying to solve this poverty issue?
Well, before the era of colonialism, people lived, of course, more rudimentary lifestyles, but actually they were rich, rich in culture, rich in leisure. They led rich lives, lives that they were content with. So their material differences from our society should not lead us to conclude that they were poor. It was the onset of colonialism that destroyed both the material basis of millions of people around the world, but also, more importantly still, in my view, their cultures. By separating people from their land, we impoverished them. So we're talking about a 400-year history. This is the modern times. Of course, in ancient times, a similar process occurred, but let's limit ourselves to talking about, you know, modern periods. For the last 400 years, our social system, that is European social system, has been one that actually manufactures poverty. Through the colonial process, Europeans took over other people's land, destroyed their relationships with their natural habitats, which consequently meant we destroyed their cultures, undermined their feeling of spirituality, their personal relationships, and all these things have to be added in when we talk about poverty. So it's been going on as a systemic process for 400 years, Carl, and it's still going on.
I was very impressed to read some of your insights into India. Can you explain how this colonial trend has evolved and how some of the principles that were set up in India during colonial periods have hung over into today's trends?
Yeah. The British moved in allegedly to trade with the Indian subcontinent. Unfortunately, the Brits didn't understand the basis of land tenure, what the land rights were, how they operated in traditional societies. So we set about rearranging people's relationship with land. And the reason why we did this was in order to tax them more effectively. Well, actually, what we did was ruin large areas where we put in place new arrangements that destroyed the economic basis of those communities. But the whole object was to tax the land in order to take away as much loot as we could back to London. In the process, of course, we damaged local cultures. Now, it was worse in some areas than in others. Where in those areas where the British didn't interfere quite so intensely with the way people lived and the way they held land and used that land, the outcome has been less damaging than in other areas. Less damaging in this sense. The British put themselves in a position where they were taxing the rent. Now, as long as they were only taxing the rent, the local communities should have survived more robustly than in other areas, and that's what's happened. So now, looking back, scholars have discovered that those areas where the damage was not so severe, because the British were effectively simply taxing the rent of the land, not altering the local people's relationship with the land, not interfering with their incomes by taxing their wages, for example, the condition of those communities is superior in terms of health and education than in the other areas where the British created a new class of landlords. In those areas, known as the zamindar regions, we created the landlords because we thought we could tax their incomes more effectively to make Britain richer, and for our bureaucrats not to have to work so hard to draw in that revenue. But the zamindars, of course, now that they were created as landlords, were only interested in pocketing all the rent and screwing the local people as hard as they could. In those areas today in India, we find that literacy rates are lower, health indices are worse than in the areas where the British didn't create the landlords. All they did was to tax the land. So while we're struggling to claim some virtues out of that Indian colonial experience, it's fair to say that in terms of proving the economics of land taxation, there is evidence that as long as government restricts its claims to the rent of land and does no more by way of interfering in people's lives, you get a better result than if you go down the landlord route.
It's very interesting. What you're really alluding to here is that it's not so much the conquering of the land or the farming of the resources there that counts. It's the capturing of the rent.
You're correct, Carl. As long as government limits itself to capturing the rent, local communities can flourish because people are working just for themselves. Of course, what was bad about India was that the rent in this case was actually taken away from the subcontinent, except that in those regions where the British were relying in a direct way on tapping the rent, they did in fact reinvest some of that rent back into the local infrastructure, particularly irrigation systems, to help with the productivity of the land. And so what we had was a little social experiment in what is the ideal way to set up economic systems between government and the producers on the land. So although India is actually a embarrassment in our colonial history, there are some micro studies that can yield insights that are relevant even to today.
And as we traverse through the book, we're hit time and again with countless examples of neo-colonial ills that have been bestowed upon countries. And one of them, in a more modern examples, is professed by one of the leaders of the so-called poverty industry, Jeffrey Sachs. And he talks about the resource curse. You have a very interesting take on this, Fred.
Yes. Because economists don't know how to solve the problem of poverty, they've got to find a scapegoat. They've got to blame somebody or something. And so one of the favorite scapegoats today in the realm of third world poverty and development is that if we blame nature, natural resources, then of course that shifts the responsibility away from our own models of how the world works and what we can do about it. So yes, it's true that in regions like the Congo, there are civil wars as people fight over gold and diamonds and so on. And so it's easy for economists like Jeffrey Sachs to say that this is a curse of nature, of natural resources, of the riches of nature, that people are somehow induced because their territories are richly endowed into fighting with each other. Well, but the trouble with this notion of the resource curse is that people like Sachs, who ought to be explaining how those natural resources can be best used to enrich everybody in society, are allowing people to think that actually having rich seams of natural resources is a curse and that they would be better off without it. Well, that's not true. Those countries with rich natural resources like Botswana, who put the rents of those natural resources to good use for the benefit of everybody, are actually richer than the areas that don't have those resources. In those cases, the resources are not a curse. So I get pretty angry when I read a term like the natural resource curse, because I know it's clever people in Harvard blaming nature when in fact they are partly responsible, because their economic theories are actually dead ends.
Now, Botswana, you mentioned before, they have defied World Bank pressure to privatize more of their natural resources. Can you tell that story for us?
Yes. Botswana was a British colony, but because it was an apparently poor colony, the British influence over the way people lived locally was minimal. In fact, the British didn't interfere at all. The result was that it wasn't in any way developed, but nor were the local cultural values and ideas and tribal ways of living damaged in the way that they would have been in much of the rest of Africa. So when independence came, and they discovered that they had diamonds on their land under the Kalahari Desert, they thought, well, actually, this is a natural resource which belongs to us all. So why are we going to privatize it? Why allowed the De Beers diamond mine people to come in and effectively take away most of the rent of these diamonds? That rent ought to belong to the people of Botswana. Well, of course, De Beers didn't like that, and they fought hard to introduce the idea of Western property rights so that they could actually privatize the rent of the diamonds. But Botswana, because it was able to retain from historical times some of the values of the tribal communities, put up a resistance, and with some shrewd legal advice from a Western lawyer, they were able to negotiate a deal where the rents of the diamonds stayed in Botswana. The result of that is that there was no resource curse in Botswana. On the contrary, their annual rate of growth, economically speaking, is two or three times higher than in neighboring countries. And there is one explanation only for that, which is that the rents of the diamonds were reinvested in the infrastructure, in health clinics, education, and so on, transport systems. And now Botswana is relatively flourishing compared with other sub-Saharan countries, which are suffering because they live under the debt of supporting property rights, which were the legacy from the colonial era.
In light of the current global financial crisis we're facing, Fred, what can governments do to avoid this level of instability that we're presently seeing?
Well, this shifts the focus now from poverty in the third world to the larger question of stabilizing a global economy that's going down the pan. It's a large question. There are things that need to be done. Look, very little can actually be done now to stop what's about to happen in the global economy. We are heading for what I forecast will be a depression. And because my warnings of 11 years ago were ignored by governments, I did alert them to the fact that this was going to happen. I provided the dates on which it was going to happen, but they took no notice. Because they lost the opportunity to do something about it in those 11 years, there is now no way to actually stop the inevitable, which is, in my view, a global depression. However, the good news is that if they came to their senses, they could actually use this period of instability to lay the foundations for a new strategy so that we don't go all the way through the next business cycle heading for a boom and a bust of the same kind that we've had repeating time and again over the last few centuries. If governments did propose that there should be a realignment of taxes, we should now shift taxes off wages and profits and onto natural resources, that would set a new framework to alert people on how they should invest for the future. At the moment, you see, one of the big problems in business is people don't know where to invest their money. Where are the new opportunities? Where are the big risks? So people are not investing. They are holding their assets in cash, and that's aggravating the credit crunch. Well, if governments offered the leadership of the kind that I've just talked about, new opportunities would become obvious. Reinvestment would start, and people could plan for the future, a future that would have less risk attached to it than at present. So, but will this happen? Well, at the moment, no. There's no sign of it happening, and therefore, I'm afraid that nothing is going to stop the worst happening, and at present, there's nothing to stop the boom-bust cycle starting all over again.
Well, Fred, I must say, for listeners out there wanting to get their head around this concept, please look up The Silver Bullet. You can find it on our bookshop, earthsharing.org.au/books. It's only $20. It's very readable, 179 pages. Fred, well done on a top book. Thank you very much for talking to us.